Hello and welcome to Fidelity Connects, a Fidelity Investments Canada podcast, connecting you to the world of investing and helping you stay ahead. On April 18th and 19th, Fidelity Investments Canada hosted Focus 2024, a two-day event for advisors featuring insights from Fidelity's portfolio managers and subject matter experts. Today's Fidelity Connects podcast brings you portfolio manager Mark Schmell's session from the event. Mark, a Fidelity veteran, manages Fidelity Global Innovators Class, Special Situations Fund, Canadian Growth Company, among others. He sits down for a nearly one-hour discussion with moderator Agnes Doherty to share his current thoughts on the market and areas of interest, including some highlights of a recent research trip overseas. Enjoy. Today's podcast was recorded on April 19th, 2024.
We're in your neck of the woods.
You are. Welcome to my hood.
Yeah. If I can get a show of hands in the audience, who owns one of Mark's products, either personally or in one of your client portfolios? Okay. I'm going to say it's like probably... Good. You had to do that. Yeah. I think that was probably everybody, and I'm sure there's a lot of hands up in the virtual room as well. So we've got a very captive audience today. I want to start off by addressing your really nice pink shoes.
Yeah, they're getting a little beat up, aren't they?
So you're wearing these back in January when I saw you at our Vision conference, and you told me these were your lucky shoes and you aren't taking them off. So great to see that they're still on. So give us the story with these pink Allbirds.
So my wife bought a bunch of Allbirds on sale, and they were on sale because there were all these colors that, you know, people didn't want, and nobody wanted pink shoes. So it was cheap. And I started wearing them 6 months ago, and the market sort of like just inflected, and it was like, huh. And I've kept wearing them. And so I wear them every day the market's open. I don't wear them on weekends. I actually just took them with me to India when I was there. They've been everywhere, and so they're still on my feet every day the market's open.
Okay,
until it finally like dies. But so far, so good.
Long live the pink Allbird rally.
Yes.
Okay.
Hopefully I'm wearing them a year from now, too.
Great. Okay, well, let's get started with the conversation. I think a good place is just talking about just your sort of general comments on the market right now. You have had great returns year to date. You've also navigated the recent volatility quite well. So give us your pulse on the market.
Sure. So I think that the key has been for me over the last 18 months. The macro is really difficult, and there's a lot of, you know, strategists with comments about interest rates and war and this and that. And I think that the most important thing for me over this period was to focus on the earnings growth of the companies on their own. So, you know, don't read the newspaper, don't listen to strategists, don't do any of the things that, you know, seem easy to do, and just talk to companies and find out what the heck is going on and follow the earnings growth. And the market, one of the reasons I've done so well is because the market's pretty narrow because it's not great out there. Interest rates are up, the consumer's soft, people are getting fired, especially white collar people. It's not great, world economy's not great, but there are pockets of incredible strength. And if you're doing the work and you're looking for stuff, that's what you own. And that's what I have owned. And I will continue to own it because that strength hasn't changed. So the answer for what's going on in the market right now is there's nothing changing. People are scared, especially the last 2 weeks, which is good because the market was getting really overheated. The market's currently punishing all the Johnny-come-latelys who said, hey, I should buy NVIDIA, it's up a lot. So hopefully those keep going down for a while and the market corrects. And so far it's been a very nice orderly correction. It probably continues for a little bit, but nothing fundamentally has changed. So the trends that were in place probably starting 12 months ago, about this time 12 months ago, if anything, are stronger than they were 12 months ago. The business is better than it was 12 months ago for all the things that I care about. And so I feel pretty good. This is my sort of market where there are opportunities to invest that are narrow and that can require a little bit more of a stomach to own. Because there's always more volatility in this type of a market. So when you have a very narrow leadership market, there's more volatility because there are fewer things to buy and you have to figure out when to buy them, what to do with them. And I'm exceedingly good at that. It's one of the things I'm really good at. So I remain bullish. I think that this is going to be a good year for stock picking. I mean, it was up 30 in the first quarter, which is a bit crazy. I'm going to give some of that back. But I think at the end of the year, things are going to be better. And I, you know, who knows what performance looks like, but I think a lot of these trends are going to be still there and still powerful. And the things that I like, I think should continue to work. Could be wrong, probably am, but that's sort of how I feel right now.
Back in September, you were talking about how some of these companies are still very cheap on a relative basis. I think Meta was maybe one of those. Is that still the case today?
They're so cheap. And it's funny, again, you read sell side research or you read the pundits and they're all like, these stocks are up a lot. They must be expensive. And it's like, they're up a lot because their earnings are up a lot. So there's one company called SMCI. They make computer things and it's up, I don't know, 600% or something. But guess what? Earnings are up like even more. So is it expensive? Maybe, but it's up because earnings are up. It's not up because people are just speculating. A lot of these stocks are up because earnings are up. And they're up a lot because business is really good. And they're not expensive if you believe the fundamentals continue to exist for like longer than the next 12 months, which I tend to, based on what I'm seeing. So they're not expensive. Meta is just not expensive. Even Nvidia is not that expensive. There's lots of cheap stocks that have incredible fundamentals. You do have to believe in the durability of the growth, but the work we've done looks like it is very durable.
Just for everyone in the audience, please enter any questions that you have for Mark into the app, and we'll get to those with time. I want to get into the topic of AI because it remains very prominent in the market. You have done incredibly well investing in AI companies in the past 12 to 18 months. Let's just kind of start high level, and if you can sort of walk us through how you see AI having the potential to change a lot of industries.
So that is actually a tricky question, and one where we don't know the answers to. AI is revolutionizing a lot of things, and we don't really know the business ramifications yet. So a lot of us, we can play around with it. We sort of know what you do with it, ChatGPT this, and you know the video creation and whatnot. Companies are all just messing around with how to make it work. Like we're messing around at Fidelity. We're trying to make it, you know, summarize research notes. We're throwing it at everything. I would say there's no killer app yet. Nobody has found the Facebook of AI. And I think that that's ways away. But what we do know is that it's disrupting everything everywhere in so many ways we can't analyze it. And what I have found in my career is that simplicity wins in the markets, not complexity. So what I'm trying to do is stay away from the complex AI situations. You know, a lot of software companies, a good example would be Adobe, right? They make the video software, which is being disrupted by AI. Does Adobe win? I don't know. Does it lose? I don't know. It's too hard. And there's a whole bucket of stocks that are simply too hard. And that's one of the reasons the market's going to struggle, because the complexity is so high. The market can't see the future, and they're just going to sit there while we try and figure out, is this an AI winner or is it a loser or is it kind of a push? So I'm avoiding those. Anywhere where I see complexity and AI revolutionizing, I don't want any part of that, because nobody knows how it's going to go down. The easier way for me to play AI is, as companies invest and experiment, they need the hardware to do it. And you know, the obvious winner was Nvidia. You bought Nvidia last year, you made a ton of money. There's a lot of non-obvious winners out there as well. And one of the trends we're seeing is Nvidia is great. They make the best machines, clearly, but it's very expensive. So, and they're very hard to get. Supply is an issue. It's just expensive and supply. Every single big company is trying to engineer around that. And they are finding solutions that are less efficient, but work, and they're cheaper, much, much cheaper. And so when you think about AI and the AI build out, it's not just going to be a whole bunch of NVIDIA machines. It's going to be a whole bunch of a lot of machines, all different types, styles, shapes, sizes. And the market only just started to figure out, wait, you know, some of these old white box vendors are now AI companies because they're selling more machines. You need more fans, you need more pumps, you need more, you know, cables, you need more boxes, you need like all kinds of stuff because these big new cheap data centers aren't as efficient. They need to be bigger, they use more power and they use more stuff. And that's a trend I think we're gonna see over the next 18 to 24 months. Companies have told us they're trying to do it. So the market has shifted gears a little bit in that, you know, maybe NVIDIA isn't the only AI stock. And you're seeing it. You're seeing it in the market. The market's figuring it out. The market's very smart. I think that the durability is the question that everyone's arguing about, is how durable is this? And I think it's pretty durable. So for me, the best way to play AI right now is simply big, dumb machines. I sort of like all the stuff that worked in the 90s. I mean, like all the little dinosaurs that, you know, we haven't owned forever. I love all those things. And I think they're really great, sneaky ways to play AI. And, you know, we'll see if it works.
Do you think that there's a possibility that other companies come in and can really truly compete with NVIDIA and what they're doing over time?
NVIDIA is so far ahead. They're at least 5 years ahead. One of the nice things about being at Fidelity is I get incredible access. So we speak to Jensen probably every 3 months, And he's very open about his roadmap and what he's trying to do. And it's just invaluable. You know, it's invaluable information. And we also do a lot of private investing in the AI space. So we know what all the leading edge folks are doing. I have more information than anybody. It's funny, we went to the AI Woodstock. I think you have a picture.
Yeah, so if we can just bring up the slide from NVIDIA conference, AI Woodstock.
So
Mark was there.
I went to this thing. It was bananas, all right? I mean, there's a picture of a marching band there. I mean, he had robots on stage. There were like, I don't know, thousands of people.
Yeah, so tell us what are we looking at here?
So
exactly?
the first picture is a conference room of one of the millions of, you know, AI talks that were given. The middle one is Jensen's keynote where he sold out, I can't remember, like it's a Staples Center or something, the hockey arena. And there were 12,000 people in there watching him basically do a pitch. And then the other one is me walking towards the arena. It was a great event. And I was there for 3 days and we got to talk to all the people who mattered again. And what was really great for me was I didn't learn anything. And it sounds funny, right? I didn't learn a damn thing. And the reason I didn't learn anything is because I already knew all this stuff. We are so far ahead of where everybody else is on AI at Fidelity in my team. And that's because we're doing so much of that. We're doing the private stuff. We are wired in. I'm sitting in San Francisco. I know more than everybody in that arena. Doesn't mean I'm going to get the stocks right. But we're so far ahead. We can sort of see where the path is going. And that's because we have the access. That's because of where I'm located and because I'm really paying attention. So that's what I learned from going to that. It wasn't that I didn't learn anything in the sessions. I learned that we're enough ahead that we should continue to be able to drive alpha in this space. So as long as AI continues to be a dominant theme in the market, we should continue to do very well.
I remember you saying when you met with Jensen and you meet with him often, you said he didn't even have all the answers to the questions that you have. But I'm curious to know, like, what are some of the questions that you're asking the CEO of NVIDIA? Like, what sort of top of mind for you when you're thinking about AI?
We do ask about applications. We ask about where it can be used. NVIDIA is doing a whole bunch of different things that they hope will drive AI adoption. He's got this thing called Omniverse, which is, you know, AI, he's built AI 3D worlds to train other AIs. Like, there's a lot of stuff that is very interesting. They're working on robots. The robot thing is really cool. Like, there's a lot of stuff they're working on, but none of it is the killer app yet. And we're all hunting for the killer app. Mm-hmm. But what we are seeing is AI being used in a variety of places. And so you ask Jensen, so what's it used for? And he's like, well, it's going to be used to create intelligence. And I had this discussion with a friend of mine just last night. I said, what's the most important commodity in the world? You know, you might say it's oil, right? Energy. It's actually not. It's intelligence. The most important commodity in the world is intelligence. Intelligence drives us forward, and we're creating it through these machines at a rate that is unbelievable. And the more intelligence you can create in your organization, the better your organization is going to be relative to the other guy. This is an existential threat. You need to invest in this. You might not know how it's going to work. You might not know where it's going to work, but your competitors are doing it. And if they figure it out before you do, you're cooked. So every single company is going to invest as much as they can in AI, and it doesn't matter what the economy does. You need this stuff. We don't know where, we don't know how, but somebody's going to figure something out. If you have nobody doing anything, you're done. And that's one of the things that Jensen says. He's like, you just need to do this. Everybody needs to do this. They need to do it at scale. It's big, it's hard, it's complicated. It needs to be close to your organization. There's a lot of things going on here. Another thing in the AI world that sort of just became new to me was, and it was funny, it was actually, we talked to Michael Dell a week ago, and one of the things he said was, you need to bring AI to your data, not data to your AI. And that is very powerful too, because so many organizations are like, oh, I'll do it in the cloud. No, you're not gonna do it in the cloud. You need to actually do it on-prem, because every organization has secret data that's their secret sauce, and it needs to sit behind the firewall, and the AI has to sit behind the firewall too. That means a whole lot more hardware has to get purchased, and you have to do a whole lot more data center work. So there's a lot of these pieces that are sort of fitting together. We don't know how it's going to be used, so don't invest in a software company, because you have no idea if it's going to exist 3 years from now. But you do know you're going to need a lot of hardware to make all this work, because it is an existential threat. Everybody's going to do it. So that's the easy trade.
Just sticking with NVIDIA for one more question. So I remember, this was probably like 8 years ago, being at a lunch with you, and you were talking about Shopify at the time. You said the biggest mistake as an investor that you can make is to sell a stock that keeps going up. And so when you think about NVIDIA, how do you manage that position? And what is your sell discipline around a stock like that?
So I'm actually doing a presentation at Fidelity in a month to talk about selling. It's one of the things I'm actually good at. In addition to migrating like these sentiment-driven markets, I'm very good at selling. So there's a couple of ways to do it. One is stocks that are working. You need to own stocks that are going up to beat the market. That's the math, right? Like, I think it's funny when folks just say, oh, I don't like that stock, it's up too much. You gotta own stocks that are going up to beat the market. That's math. But the stocks that are going up, they can be risky, there can be downside, there can be all these different things you think about. So managing position sizing is crucial. So the first rule is don't sell stocks that are going up that you own. Just don't do that. Unless you have a fundamental reason, like, I don't know, something changed, but don't sell those stocks. But do manage position sizes. So especially as you get more money, so when I'm running a lot more money, I have to really be careful on position sizing, because when things do break, you need to be able to sell it. So you have to make sure your position doesn't grow too large. So you're always sort of slowly trimming your winners into these rallies, because you just don't want to own too much, right? So NVIDIA, I think, has tripled on me. And if I hadn't sold a share, it would be, oh, I don't know, 30% of my fund, some ridiculous number. So you got to manage your position sizing so that when things do change, you can sell it. And then when it does change, you sell it as fast as you can. Now that's me. Not everyone has that style, but that's how I approach these things. So I'm always sort of active, and mostly it's because I slowly trim my winners as they rise, but I never sell them completely. I don't sell them completely until the story is dead, dead, dead. You know, goes over the cliff. I'm the over the cliff guy, but I sell them very quickly once they go over the cliff. But finding stocks that work is hard, so don't sell them, ever.
Let's talk about the, as you sort of alluded to earlier, the ancient tech dinosaurs that are now AI plays, was I think how you described them previously. So some of those are in your top 10 now, Dell and Broadcom. So let's maybe just dive into both of those a little bit more. So you kind of alluded to some of it there at the start, but if we can just go a little bit deeper into why you like those.
Sure. So first, let's talk about Broadcom, which I didn't own at all last year. And that was sort of a fundamental error on my part. I didn't understand what it was. And this is why you do the work and you come in every day. And like, there's so many companies, you just don't know them all. And I wasn't on top of Broadcom. It's a big company. It's like hundreds of millions of market cap. And I'm like, I don't know it enough. And it was, you know, I did more work on it. And I was like, is this AI? What is this? It's like a bunch of software companies, CEO Hawk, who's actually a really good businessman. And it's got like all this weird semiconductor stuff that I didn't really know what it was. You know, it was complicated. It was a complicated story. And I'm not very good at complicated. I just told you guys I hate complicated. And so I just avoided it. But I was in a meeting with a different company called Arista, who makes Ethernet cables. You're going to need a lot of Ethernet cables in these AI super machine things. And the CTO said, Broadcom's got the best people on our problem. Like, they're just really great. They work really hard. We can't find anyone better than Broadcom. And I'd never heard that before. I'd always thought of Broadcom as this weird collection of assets. So we did more work on it. We started to realize that Broadcom's actually a really good AI play. It's kind of a sneaky AI play that wasn't really apparent at a surface level. And so it went into my bucket of sleepy AI plays that are not AI plays, but suddenly start to become AI plays. And that's why I started to buy it. And it was a good place to, you know, park money that was coming out of other AI stuff. You know, as you manage position sizing and your, you know, favorite AI names, you can migrate some of those dollars over to the bank shot AI names, which is what I've been doing. And then the other one you mentioned, what was it, with Dell?
Yeah.
Okay, I have to make sure I can talk about that, you know.
Yeah, it's in your top 10.
So, and Dell is the same thing. I started buying Dell last year. And so here's a story, right? How to make money versus how to be an analyst. Dell had a quarter, it went up 20%. I had no idea what was going on there, like zero. Like, I hadn't talked to or looked at Dell in 10 years. I haven't owned a Dell, I've owned Apple machines forever. And I looked at it, it was up 20% because they beat the number on this like one little server chunk. And they said in this server chunk, there was an AI server. But I started buying it. I hadn't done any work on it, the stock was up. They mentioned AI in the press release, and I just started buying it every day. And then I did more work on it. And the more work I did, the more I started to understand, oh, they have all this AI server that I didn't know. And then, you know, fast forward 3 months, I learned a bit more. It's like, oh, you know, this AI server, more people want it. And then forward a few more months, it's like, oh, people are starting to engineer away from NVIDIA. So it's a process, right? As you learn more about each company, you buy more and more. So you start with a small bet because stock's going up. I like stocks that are going up. You do some work, you buy a little bit more. You do some more work, you buy a little bit more. And then eventually the position size gets big. And the idea is to own big bets in things you really believe are going to work. And so for me, Dell looks like a wonderful mispriced dinosaur. They used to trade at 30 times earnings. You know, back in the day when that guy would get a Dell was, you know, 1995, 96. Remember those commercials? Probably not. Anyway, I remember those commercials. And now it trades at 16 times or something like that, 17 times, something like that. And earnings are too low. Earnings are going to go up because they're going to sell a lot more boxes into these AI superstructure things. And folks didn't think it was an AI company. Well, they're starting to figure it out, but it's a really great play, and it's a tech dinosaur that nobody's looked at in any meaningful way for 10 years. It traded at 6 times earnings. I think I started buying it at 10 times earnings, and that was 10 times non-AI earnings. So now the earnings are starting to go like this. It's getting cheaper and cheaper as the stock goes up, which is a wonderful scenario. You know, people say, well, the stock's up, I can't own it. It's like, who cares? Earnings are up more. So stock's actually cheaper. So these tech dinosaurs, they're making commodity boxes. They're all AI companies. It's hysterical.
We have a question from the audience here. Are semiconductors cyclical businesses? And if so, should that be a concern?
Yes, they are cyclical businesses, commodities. But some cycles are long. And it's interesting, in semiconductors, actually 80% of semiconductors is terrible. TSMC just put up terrible numbers. The semi-cap guys are putting up terrible numbers. If you're not in AI, your business is terrible, right? EVs are terrible, nobody's buying cars, housing sucks, like everything's terrible. But if you're in AI, it's absolutely on fire. So the key with semiconductors is to buy the stuff that benefits from the AI build out, the data center stuff. You gotta find your spots. And that's where stock picking works, right? You can't just buy the market. The market's gonna be terrible. You gotta own the right sectors of the market. And if you're comfortable with the volatility you're gonna get by owning just a small sector, because that's what happens every time, I think you'll be fine. So yes, they are cyclical. Yes, you should always be concerned. At the moment, I think the AI story is a 3 to 5 year spending cycle in my personal view. So I think that a lot of them will be fine.
People continue to talk about the sort of picks and shovels approach. Is that, would you sort of describe like Dell and Broadcom, those are your picks and shovels. Is there anything else sort of like in the industrial space that you're looking at that could be described as like a second derivative play?
There's a lot of things in the industrial side, mostly about the electrical stuff, the things like Eaton. There's a whole range of companies that sell into data centers. I did briefly own a company that just does foundation pouring for data centers. And then I realized that's probably a really bad idea because all they do is pour concrete and it was getting an AI multiple. So I sold that one. But the market's figuring this out. And this is why we're correcting. There are very few winners. We have more or less found them all now. And the market is not, you know, it knows, right? So there's this stock, Vertiv, which I own. They do cooling. It trades at like a 35 multiple now. It's like a cooling, industrial cooling pump company. It should never trade at 30 times. And it's because it's gotten the AI premium. Everyone buys it because they all know we need cooling. And it's a thematic stock. This is where position sizing matters. It's still an industrial. Don't chase industrials too hard, right? Because they don't trade like tech stocks. So when the wheels come off and you want to go sell your industrial something, you're never going to get out of that thing. So it's a tricky market. And I think that everyone needs to be cognizant that it is going to be difficult to navigate. And one of the things I am good at is navigating this sort of thing. Even with all that money, I'm still pretty nimble. But there are lots of bank shots. But I would say most of the bank shots have been found. And so now it's a question of how long do you think this is going to last? And where do I think that the most upside is still remaining in some of these names?
So as we sort of wrap up this long AI discussion, I think a lot of people are trying to call the winners. Mm-hmm. Our president, Rob Strickland, was sort of giving me a history lesson on the dawn of the internet. And everybody thought that like Cisco and Nortel were going to be the winners. And that it was like Amazon and Google that ultimately were. So do you sort of feel like it's similar today with AI that we're just really at the early innings and there's a long
way to go? So we're so early.
Yeah.
So the internet build out was driven by telecom companies. So telecom companies were the data of the hyperscalers of their day, right? Regulated utilities, they could spend as much money as they wanted to. They issued all this debt, they built the internet, then they all went bankrupt. We're kind of doing the same thing. Now it's the data center companies and sovereign governments spending all the money, and they have infinite balance sheets and they can spend whatever they want. And they're building out the AI internet, whatever that is. So yes, it's exactly the same. We don't know who the winners are on AI. Nobody has a clue, which is why I'm not touching anything in software, because it's scary. I mean, these companies could be revolutionized away tomorrow, or they might be huge winners. So the idea is to stay on it and find out who's a winner. So the only winner I have found so far that uses AI and is meaningfully accelerating their business is Meta. So Meta is using it, and to a lesser extent, actually, like TikTok, Meta, not quite Snap, but the direct-to-consumer advertising companies are really using AI and using it well, and it's magnifying their results. So when we talked to the CEO of Broadcom, he sits on the board of Meta, and he's like, for every dollar Meta puts into AI, they get $2 back in terms of earnings and revenue. So they're harvesting from all this intelligence they're putting in. So there are places where you're seeing massive at-scale AI benefits. And those are ones I'm happy to own, those types of stocks. There's not very many. I haven't found very many where you can say, well, AI is really accelerating your business and making it better. But in most cases, it's just a cost. No one's figured out what to do with it.
So you brought a prop with you.
I did.
You and your pink Allbirds went to India last week.
I was there.
So tell us all about your India trip.
It was great. So you probably all know I invest in privates, and we did a private company India trip. And it was, you know, I've never been to India, so it was great. I actually ran into a planner in the Mumbai airport. He's like, Mark, what are you doing in India? You're seed companies. So one of the companies that is a private of mine, and we got to see them live in India, which is great. And they make glasses like this. And it's an amazing story. They manufacture them in India. They sell them to Indians cheap. This cost me like $8. They do the eye test in the store. It takes 5 minutes. And you can get two pairs of glasses for $20. And it's like fast fashion for glasses. Who doesn't want to have more than one pair of glasses? I have one pair of glasses and I hate them. I wish I could have like a whole bunch of fun ones, but I have to go to the optometrist. I got to like spend all this money. They're really expensive. These guys are going to ship it to you anywhere in the world, $20, two glasses every time. You can do the vision test online. It's fun. It's phenomenal. It happens to be in India. It's a great company. There's a lot of really good stuff in India that is not related to, you know, the usual emerging market stuff. A lot of really smart entrepreneurs, tech entrepreneurs, consumer entrepreneurs. The economy is so interesting and different, and they have different business models. This is what, you know, one of the powers of the Fidelity model. I've got Gaurav, my guy, he's based in Singapore. He's in India like every month, looking for people, looking for companies, and we have incredible access. When we were down there, we met six of the richest men, they're all men, in India, because we're Fidelity and we had the access. And that's just really powerful. And then they sit there and they tell you, we're gonna invest in data centers because we need to invest in AI. And you know, like, you get to see the same trends occurring all around the world. And part of investing in private companies is, yeah, it's nice to make money, but it's more important to have access. So when you invest in some of these early frontier model companies, or you invest in some of the, you know, data center companies, they give you information that you can use for your public market investing. And that is the most useful thing. All that sort of information is very powerful when you can then take it and invest in the rest of the market. So private investing is super important. Not always just to make money on the private investment. And I have an entire team. There's six or seven. Three of them are in San Francisco. And we're working them really hard.
So you met with a lot of companies and you were there, right? Over 100, was it?
Yeah, I met with 50 companies in 5 days.
That's a lot.
Three cities.
Wow.
We saw everything. And it was really great. And the thing about India, just India on its own, is there's a lot of hype about India. I often get the question of, what are you buying in India? But it does remind me a lot of China in 2004. I went to China in 2004, and I remember seeing what it was like, and then I was just in India, and it feels exactly the same to me. So I think that the Indian economy is going to be a 20-year cycle, and there's a lot of fear that AI is going to wipe out their tech business. I don't think that matters. I think that it's more of a consumer driven story inside of India. And I think that the surface is, don't buy Indian stocks because AI is going to wipe out their tech industry. And I think that misses the whole point. It does look like China, you know, 20 years ago. So that could be a very powerful component to the global economy as we move forward. So it was very interesting.
Great. Learned a lot. Question from the audience here. What risks do you think the markets may be overlooking when it comes to AI? What are we not thinking about?
Well, white collar employment. So I think that what the market is not thinking about, is because it can't, is the complexity. Like, how do we use it? I think that is the $1 million question. I think what the big risk is that AI turns out to be useless. I think that's the only risk. So we do all this investing in it, and then we find out, hey, I can't use it for, ChatGPT doesn't work for all the things I wanted to do it. Use it for, and therefore I'm just going to stop. I think that's the big risk. I am seeing enough utilities that I don't think that's the case. So I'll give you another example. When we were in India, there was a makeup company, an Indian makeup company, and he's a software engineer. He knows nothing about makeup. They are using AI to do product development. So they have the AI run a scan globally on all the chemical terms that are being used in the beauty business, which ones are being searched for more, what are the products that we should be on. And like it just presents, okay, we need to do, I don't know, there's some sort of acid. We need to do this one because everyone's searching for it. We don't even know what it is, and they make a product around it, and then it starts to sell. They're also using AI to do their advertising, which is they find an influencer. The AI writes all the material for the influencer, produces the influencer's video for the influencer. It's all done by a machine. He showed us. He said, we hacked this together in 3 days. And their ad dollars, like, just going crazy. And it took them almost no work. So you're seeing AI applications that actually work. So I don't think that risk is a big one. But I think that's the biggest risk, is we find that we've invested all this time and money in AI and it doesn't do anything. But I'm definitely seeing use cases that are very powerful. And I do think it's an existential threat to a lot of companies. So they're going to invest in it. So that, for me, that's the big risk. The other big risk is obviously that each new model doesn't get better. So you saw Llama 3 came out from Meta, Claude 3 came out. If the scaling laws stop applying and the models stop getting smarter, we also have a problem. So for me, those are the two risks. We can't find a use for all the AI stuff we built, and the models plateau. But so far, it looks like the models are not plateauing. They're still accelerating. And most of the researchers I've talked to said half algorithm, half compute. So I think we've still got a ways to go. And I think these things keep getting smarter.
Do you worry about regulation for AI?
So yes, but I think that what's going to happen, and this is what has happened in every other tech cycle, is regulation is so far behind that the world will have changed by the time the regulators get there. It's kind of like, remember when we had music, the music industry got wiped out, and it took what, 15 years to sort of figure out how to make that work? And case law and regulation, it took a long time. We finally got there, but it took a long time. And I think you're going to see the same thing occur in AI. Right now, there are issues about copyright. You know, they trained all these models on copyrighted material. Who owns the... It is complicated, and governments are not going to be able to get it right very quickly. And I think the companies are just going to push ahead, because that's what companies always do. And the regulation will slowly catch up. I mean, we're still trying to regulate Facebook, right? We're still doing that, the privacy rules. And Facebook's been around for how many years? 15? I don't know what it is. So yeah. We're still trying to regulate search. By the time we regulate Google, we're going to have AI wiping Google out. So I don't. I guess that's a long way to say I don't really think about it too much.
Okay. So we do know that AI obviously uses an incredible amount of energy, so mm-hmm. 6 to 8 times more. Mm-hmm. And we've talked in the past about the electrification trend. You have some investments in the nuclear space. Why do you like nuclear so much? And how do you think about other alternative energy sources?
So I like nuclear because it provides base load power, which is what all these data centers require. In fact, Amazon just signed a big nuclear deal with Constellation at $86 a megawatt to power their data centers. It's like perfect for data centers. It's gotta stay flat and gotta always be there. And I like nuclear because it's green. I mean, nuclear waste is a problem, 100%. But at the moment, the bigger problem is carbon. It's carbon free. It's a green solution. There's a lot of uranium out there. So, you know, you can power stuff for a very long time. I just feel like it's the only answer to climate change, like the only legitimate big answer. And you've got this period of time where everyone's starting to realize that, like, demand is starting to go up. People are getting excited about nuclear again. And it's hitting at a time when there's a really creaky supply chain, because nuclear has not been in fashion since the 70s. So there's like nobody left. There's like 5 companies left to do all this work. So when you have improving demand and a shaky supply chain, it's usually a good place to own the shaky supply chain. So that's what I do. And I really do think nuclear is a good viable solution to our current climate problem. And I think that we should be able to find a nuclear waste solution. There's got to be one. I mean, there's some really deep mines in Sudbury that go down like, I don't know, 4 miles. Put it down there. I don't know anything about nuclear waste. I know it's a big problem. That's not really my purview. I just think it is a really good solution to our current climate problem. And our climate problem is only getting worse, right?
Right.
It's getting hotter. How much snow did you guys have? Like, probably none. there was no winter this year in Boston. It's just crazy, and it's going to get worse. So we're going to need nuclear. It's the only solution that I can see.
I wanted to ask you more of sort of a process-oriented question, and it's around sort of the tension that you have in having really high conviction in an idea, but also having the conviction to change. And if I can use sort of an example, so we all know back in 2022, you had a lot of energy in your portfolios. Global Innovators was around 30% energy. Mm-hmm. I remember, so as a wholesaler at the time, we were on an internal sales call with you. It was maybe like end of August, early September 2022. And you said, I sold all my energy and I'm buying tech. And at that point, rates were still going up. Inflation was still very high. And I remember thinking on that call, oh God, I hope you're right. And you know, the market bottomed in October. And it's just been, you know, gangbusters ever since. And so, I mean, you run billions and billions of dollars, 25, 30, but what's your AUM now?
25 US, 35 Canadian.
Okay. So
it's a lot.
How do you, like, you have to have so much courage and conviction to make those sort of bold calls. So can you just give us some insight into what happens in your mind when you're making those decisions?
I think that it's just a function of my investment style that allows me to do that. It's the way I run money. It's the way my, okay, this is a boring word for me, but it's my process. My process allows me to shift. In fact, my process forces me to shift, even when I don't want to shift. Because when I see things moving in a certain direction, let's say the stocks are going up, I start buying them. You know, I'm a classic momentum investor. I'm just really good at it. So momentum is this swear word in investing. You know, you never should be a momentum investor. I think I should write a book and say, embrace being a momentum investor. Just be really good at it, because it's really what I do. So I try and own stocks that are going up, and I try and sell stocks that are going down, and I do it very quickly. And you need to understand why they're doing those things. You can't just be a chart monkey and go, I'm going to buy it because it's going up, and I'm going to sell it because it's going up. You need to understand the why. Why is this happening? Why are these stocks going up? Because that allows you to build conviction one way or another. If you understand that, you know, you're selling the stock because the story has changed, you have a lot of conviction. You can sell it very quickly. Same is true on the buy thesis. You know, if the story changed and you start buying it, you understand the why, that helps you with the conviction side. So I think in a lot of those cases where I shift gears, it's because of my process. And it's just the way I run money. And it's how I think about markets. That's how I've always done it. And I can remember when I started Special Situations, and Andrew's in the front row. Andrew and I had a conversation about what kind of capacity you think that we have. And I'm like, $1 billion, probably around $1 billion. Because I had a high turnover, you know, I turned that thing over 200% a year. You know what's funny? It still works. And I still turn it over 200% a year. And the process hasn't changed. I mean, I'm doing exactly the same job with more money. So far, it hasn't been a problem. And I don't know why, because it should be. But it's not. It hasn't been. So maybe I think I've become a better portfolio manager at running larger sums of money. I have strategies now on how to deal with it. And I've really had no issues shifting gears at all, which is astonishing. So yeah, it's a function of the process.
A unique talent. So crypto is in your portfolio. You told me that you made a lot of money on crypto. So if you can share, I think you've got a really good story around MicroStrategy, and maybe you can tell us a little bit about the internal competition that you had.
Yeah, so every year we have a competition inside Fidelity. It's the Fidelity stock picking competition. And there are two components. One is who has the most entertaining presentation. You get two tickets to anywhere for dinner. And who wins the absolute performance? And that person gets four tickets to a dinner anywhere they want to go. So last year I picked MicroStrategies. And the reason I picked MicroStrategy was I went to that AI conference where I made a lot of money by listening to, oh, AI is like the thing. And everybody at that conference, A, pivoted from crypto to AI. B, said, crypto's dead, so stupid. Why did we ever invest in it? Dumb board monkeys. Like, this is the stupidest thing ever. Like, they were just trashing crypto, like you wouldn't believe. And I kind of always have liked Bitcoin. So I'm like, you know, I should buy this thing because everybody hates it. It's like completely washed out. MicroStrategy is just a pure Bitcoin play. He's a CEO who goes and uses his balance sheet and buys Bitcoin. I mean, that's it. It's basically moves with Bitcoin. So I pitched Bitcoin for the stock competition. It was at 200, it was at 350 bucks a share. And I actually owned a lot of it in my portfolios. I think I at one point I owned 8% of the company. And it's now what, 1800 or something like that?
Just so, pause for a moment there. I don't know that there's many investors in the...
That was just a MicroStrategy.
Yeah.
So yeah, and then I did win the stock competition.
And you I should. Think, That's so awesome.
I get my 4 tickets and I'm going to French Laundry. And,
nice. Awesome. It's hard to get a reservation there though. I'm sure you have connections.
I don't have any connections. Okay. If anyone knows how to get a reservation at French Laundry, let me know.
And then Coinbase is the other one that's in your top 10 now.
I love Coinbase. Coinbase is great. It's, you know, they are passionate about what they're doing. They're smart about what they're doing. They're doing it legally. They're checking all the box. It's a really great compliance sort of organization. And they're really trying to do it right. And which is great because there were so many fraudsters out there who did it wrong, right? And all the fraud guys are now going to jail. Coinbase is the only one standing. They're the only guys left. And so if you think, and I do think, that you know crypto has a future, Coinbase is it. There's nobody left. The big companies, like Fidelity's involved a little bit. We have launched the ETF, the Bitcoin ETF. You can buy crypto on the Fidelity platform. It's the only really major financial institution that's in the space in any meaningful way. And even there, we're like tiptoeing our way in. We don't do a lot of the fancy stuff because it's not settled law yet. Coinbase is forcing the law. They're doing the lawsuits. They're pushing legislation. And they're building what we call moats. You know, you're supposed to buy those companies that have moats. Coinbase has got huge moats. I think it's just a great idea. And I do believe Bitcoin has a role in the world. I don't know about the rest of crypto, but Bitcoin sure does. And I think that if Bitcoin does well, the whole ecosystem will do well and Coinbase will benefit. It's a pretty simple thesis. It's been a good stock. I think the Coinbase management's pretty good. They're doing it the legal way. And I believe Bitcoin is a viable investment option.
I asked Dan DuPont yesterday, gold versus Bitcoin, and he said gold. I'm assuming you're going to say Bitcoin.
Bitcoin.
That's the beauty of Fidelity, right? It's the diversity of thought that we have between our different PMs.
Yes.
Hugo was on stage yesterday, and he talked about commodities. Mm-hmm. And so what's your thought on commodities these days?
Commodities are scaring me a little bit. So you mentioned, what am I worried about in AI? I'm not really worried about AI, but I am worried about commodities. They're going up in a terrible economy. So maybe the economy is not as terrible as we all think it is. So it is definitely a conundrum. It's one of those black swans you think about. It's like, well, what's going on with commodities? Like gold is going straight up, even though the US dollar is going straight up. That is unusual. And so when something's unusual, I like to pay attention to it and try and figure it out. So far, I haven't figured it out. And I'm asking everybody, like I talked to Hugo, what's going on? He's like, I don't know. I think it's tricky. The other commodity that you have to really watch is oil. And as oil goes, so goes inflation. And oil has definitely perked up. Is that because of the war? I don't know. So I am definitely paying attention to commodities. And me being me, gold's going up. Well, I'll start buying gold companies. This is what I do, right? I like to own things that are getting better and sell things that are getting worse. I'm not sure I'm there yet. I don't know that I believe in this commodity strength, but I'm paying attention to it. It's something I think about. If oil goes to 100, things are not going to be great. That said, honestly, these companies are still going to spend on AI. I don't care where oil goes because it's an existential threat. So, you know, I'm paying a relative. I think the AI companies on a relative basis will probably still do fine. They'll all go down. Everything will go down if oil goes to 100. But I don't think I would change my investment strategy at all.
So I mentioned Dan and Hugo, and that's a segue into our Global Equity Plus strategy. So we talked about it a lot. We're launching it in an active ETF and a balanced version in May. Over $2 billion, the fastest AUM growth of a fund at Fidelity, so it's been incredibly successful. Just tell me a little bit about your thoughts on Global Equity Plus. Like, I think you mentioned at one point it's the only other fund you would buy outside of your own individual funds.
I would. I think it's really great for clients who want less volatility. I think it's going to ease out the volatility of all of our styles, right? And that's probably great for a lot of investors who get nervous. Because investors always get nervous. I ran into some people in the hallway and everyone's nervous. You need to keep people in the market. And so I always tell folks with my funds, just don't look at them, buy them every month. You know, over time, you're going to do fine. And some people can't do that, right? They can't stomach the volatility. So I think that this product will do a great job of reducing the volatility and still giving you the alpha that you want. So from that perspective, I think it's great.
Last question for you, and I asked Dan the same, and it just our gift back to the audience. You always talk about how you read a lot. So I wanted you to share your favorite book and then maybe your favorite blog as well.
Oh, God.
You can say multiple things. We can take a couple.
Favorite book. You need to prep me for that one.
It was on the prep sheet. I don't know. You didn't read it. That's not my problem.
all right. So my favorite magazine is The Economist. I like it. I like a lot of the science rags, like Scientific American, Nature, MIT does a really good one. I'm a future forward sort of person, so that's the type of stuff I like to read. I don't read any finance books. Pointless. They just teach you how to be a value investor. That's like not helpful, right? When was the last time you ever saw a growth book? Never. Because growth investors sound stupid.
Well, you're going to write a momentum book, so we'll all
buy
that.
Yeah, but no one will buy it. They all want to buy it. They all want to buy the like discounted free cash flow, Warren Buffett, like, well, whatever. So no finance books. Never read a management book. Those are pointless. So my favorite book? Jumpin'. It's probably something in science fiction, because that's what I like to read. I read powder puff science fiction. That's what I like. Doesn't help me with investing in any way, but it's distraction, and distraction is cool because it's very hard. This job is very hard. You know, go to the gym, read powder puff science fiction, don't read finance books, and pay attention to the markets, and that's what I do.
Great.
So yeah.
I would just like to wrap up by saying, Mark, I've owned your fund since I started working at Fidelity over a decade ago. When I was a wholesaler, people would always say to me, is now a good time to buy Mark Schmale? And I would always say, it's always a good time to buy Mark Schmale. And it's an even better time to buy Mark Schmale whenever his fund dips a little bit. But Mark, thank you so much for being such an incredible investor. It's been an honor to speak with you today.
Oh, it's been great to be here.
Thank you for listening to the Fidelity Connects podcast. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe to Fidelity Connects on your podcast platform of choice. And if you like what you're hearing, leave a review or a 5-star rating. Fidelity mutual funds and ETFs are available by working with a financial advisor or through an online brokerage account. Visit fidelity.ca/howtobuy for more information. Thanks again. See you tomorrow. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of Fidelity Investments Canada ULC or its affiliates. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment, tax, or legal advice. It is not an offer to sell or buy, or an endorsement, recommendation, or sponsorship of any entity or security cited. Read a fund's prospectus before investing. Funds are not guaranteed. Their values change frequently, and past performance may not be repeated. Fees, expenses, and commissions are all associated with fund investments,